Thank you for tuning in to the Best of Movie Geeks United, a collection of some of our most memorable conversations from our archives. Tonight we have a trio of wildly different and fascinating actors, including action star Dolph Lundgren, followed by character actor extraordinaire Robert Forrester, and finally, Hellboy himself, Ron Perlman. Since we first announced our guest for today's show, we've been flooded with emails from fans all over the world, from Denver to Romania. There's no doubt about it, Dolph Lundgren is an international movie star phenomenon. Making his big screen debut in 1985's James Bond adventure A View to a Kill, shortly before soaring to superstardom as Ivan Drago in Rocky IV, he's built a remarkable career and a string of films that make even the most jaded action fans salivate. Pictures like Masters of the Universe, Red Scorpion, The Punisher, Showdown in Little Tokyo. In recent years, this multi-talented actor has broadened his creative muscles by turning to writing and directing as well. In his fantastically entertaining new film, Missionary Man, Dolph pulls triple duty, not only writing and directing, but starring as writer, a mysterious loner with a taste for vengeance and a desire for justice who attempts to liberate a small town from a malicious oppressor. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show a true action cinema icon, Mr. Dolph Lundgren. Dolph, are you with us?
Yes. Thank you for that beautiful introduction. Thank you.
Well, you deserve it, absolutely. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's very exciting to have you on Movie Geeks United, so thank you so much. I wanted to start out by I read about your education and how you received a master's degree in chemical engineering from the University of Sydney, and then you were attending Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and you left after 2 years to pursue acting. Was that around the time that the acting bug first hit you, and what about acting made you feel so passionate about it that you knew that that was what you wanted to do with your life?
I'd done some acting when I was in junior high, and then I got sidetracked in chemical engineering because my dad was an engineer and my older brother was an engineer, and I wanted to travel. I couldn't afford it, and I could get some scholarships by doing good in school. But then when I got up to MIT and I was kind of faced with the prospect of doing this for the rest of my life, I don't know, it didn't feel totally right. And I was doing a little modeling on the side and started doing a little bit of acting for some reason. And it was just something about acting, something creative and kind of passionate and something I hadn't done before. I'd done sports and I'd done intellectual things in school, but I never really engaging myself, you know, on an emotional level. And
right.
And there was just also the adventure of Hollywood and the prospect of being in the movies. Everybody said I should try it. And I just, I don't know, I just took it on, went out on a limb and just went for it.
It was definitely worth it. I mean, your life has definitely been an adventure as a result. So have you always thought about writing and directing as well? Has that always been an ultimate goal of yours?
Not really. It's been in the back of my mind, but I've been busy working. I haven't really thought about it I'm not that much of a planner. I kind of just let things happen for some reason.
Right.
Think as an engineer, I'd be sort of like totally, you know, having my 10-year plan. But I don't. So, you know, I started helping out, working on screenplays with different directors I worked with, and I had some ideas and they would think they were pretty good, so I'd work with a writer, I'd work directly with a director, and then, you know, one thing led to another, and a couple of years ago I was working with a director in London and on a script, and you know, he got sick, and the producers came to me and said, hey, how about you directing this picture? And I was like, well, that's a tall order. That's a difficult question. I asked my wife, and I was thought about it, and then I said yes, and didn't sleep for about a month because I didn't have any pre-production time, but it was a good experience. I really enjoyed it, and I realized that I kind of almost enjoy more telling a story and trying to affect the audience than actually being an actor and just being one color instead of being, you know, the one who paints the whole picture.
That's what I was wondering about, because obviously acting satisfies some creative instinct in you, and if writing and directing kind of stimulate different aspects of that for you.
Well, it definitely does. I mean, you're the one who telling it's your story. It's your version of telling the story to the audience. And I don't know exactly where it comes from, but I suppose it's some instinct that some people have. You just want to tell the story, whether it's in music or in a painting or with a film, and you know, you're trying to express yourself on some level, and then you'd like to affect and to affect the audience as well. As an actor, you're a little, you know, it's a nice experience to express yourself as an actor, but you're still a little bit limited, in my opinion, because you know you're only one color instead of being, like I said, the one who does the painting. So
yeah.
For me, it's a fresh start to have more responsibility and to be able to use more skills, not just the acting skill, but other skills to organize people and to deal with technical matters and deal with the actors and deal with the budget, and it's just more challenging.
Well, you've certainly seen Stallone do it. You know, he's a triple threat, much like you are. But it has to be very daunting to wear those different hats. And are you always in jeopardy of one kind of the quality of one area kind of being sacrificed for the other? How do you maintain all three hats?
Well, you're right. Yeah, it is difficult. And I did see Stallone do it on my first picture, even though I was, you know, many years away from it myself, but I saw him coming in with a lot of preparation and determination, and a lot of people wanting him to fail, doing, you know, another Rocky picture, and he didn't. I mean, he did a good job on Rocky IV, and he's made a couple of sense even. But in my case, you do have to strike that balance where, you know, you as a director, your ultimate responsibility is to the producer to deliver the picture and to satisfy the fans, and you, that's kind of what's on your mind all the time, and also, you know, deliver on time and on budget. So what has to happen is your acting comes in second. It's like, you know, you're doing everything else, and you got to walk in front of the camera, and like, damn, I'm going to act here. Shit. And then you're up against some really good actor who's all prepared, and you're like, oh, man. What happens? You kind of learn to simplify things and just trust your instincts and not kind of complicated. And then you kind of also know that, you know, in post you can tweak it a little bit. And that's my next step, I think, is to take a little more time to prepare myself as an actor so I feel a little more confident and can just leave it alone during the shoot. Otherwise, you tend to shortchange yourself.
Well, you mentioned actors, and you have fantastic performances in this movie. And talking about making a movie for your fans, I mean, this is a movie that your fans are going to eat up. It's fantastically entertaining. It's great fun. Tell me a little bit about it. What inspired you to write it, and tell our audience a little bit about the plot of the film.
Well, I wanted to make a Western. I love Westerns, and I always watched them since I was a kid. And so I had this idea of doing a modern Western on an Indian reservation, on American Indian reservation, contemporary. Instead of horses, I would use motorcycles. So that was kind of that was the kernel. That was my idea of the setting. And then I read this article in the New York Times about drug trafficking through Indian lands, how some bad guys use the reservations because it's very difficult to police them because the jurisdiction, it's, you know, local state police can't go in because it's like federal lands. The feds have to come in, but they're too far away. So it's very easy to smuggle drugs through some reservations. So I kind of came up with a story, you know, where a stranger rolls into town on a bike and he's there and he helps this Indian family against some bad guys. But yeah, as the story progresses, he realizes he's there for another reason. He's there for something that happened a long time ago, and it's about, like in old Westerns, revenge and redemption. And it has a little bit of a biblical theme as well.
It really deals with those timeless themes that you know, they're timeless for a reason. I mean, they have such dramatic weight to them. It's a real special movie, and it has a unique look to it as well, and I was wondering what kind of thinking went into creating the actual look of the movie.
Well, I had sort of an idea of making it gritty and real from the beginning and not trying to glamorize the violence too much, making it pretty simple, the way any you know, a fight, something you could see happen in the street. I had, for budgetary reasons, I ended up shooting on Super 16, which gives it a kind of a grainy, gritty look anyway. And then I thought that if I wanted to sort of strengthen that by, you know, in color correction, by going to desaturate the picture, to make it even starker, so that you kind of have to work a little more as a viewer. It's not very, you know, the picture isn't necessarily inviting, so you have to sort of work a little bit as a viewer, not just for the story, but with the picture as well. So that's kind of my idea.
So Missionary Man, it releases on DVD. Does it release on DVD Tuesday the 22nd? Or this coming
Tuesday? I believe so, yeah.
Tuesday the 22nd.
What's the 21st, I think it is. 21st, 22nd.
Yeah, Tuesday the 22nd on DVD shelves. I know your time is very brief with us, but I have to ask you a couple of these fan questions. I've been bombarded with them, and they're going to kill me if I don't get to them.
No, cool. No, great.
Sean wrote me, and he wants to know if two of your previous films, Renegade and Diamond Dogs, will be released on DVD soon.
Diamond Dogs, yes. I think it's coming out. Sony has that. Sony Screen Gems has that. It's coming out, believe, this year. And the other one, I don't know which one that he's talking about. Does he mean it's maybe Retrograde? That's the one he means. Retrograde.
Yes.
Yeah, that's coming. I'm not sure about that one, what's going on with that one. But I'll try to find out.
But
you know.
Karina wants to know if you have plans to return to Romania for a future film.
Return to where?
Romania.
Yes. I'd love to go to Romania. I may be in Bulgaria, as a matter of fact, for a picture. There's one film I like to direct that I can shoot in Eastern Europe. So I may be in Bulgaria, which is his next door. Hopefully I can come and visit Romania as well, because there are a lot of great things to see there.
Well, give us a heads up, and we'll make sure that she knows, so she can be right there with you.
Thanks, appreciate it. Yeah, let her
know. What's next for you? I read that there's an Indiana Jones style adventure on the horizon for you. Is that what's next for you?
No. You know, I'm working on a script. I mean, I've got an acting gig just as an actor, you know, that I like to do just to hang out in a trailer and relax a little bit instead of running around working too much.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to take a bit of a break there, but I got a script I'm working on. That's about an assassin that I've been working on for a while. And I like to sort of play a heavier character. It's an idea I've had for a couple of years, and I'm working on the script right now, and hopefully I can direct that sometime this year.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great. I know you have to wrap things up, but we have a caller. Let's take the caller, and then we'll let you off the hook, if that's
thanks,
okay. Caller from 757 area code. Go right ahead.
Hey, Dolph. This is Jonathan Moody. How are you doing?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks, man. Yeah, good to hear from you.
I was just wondering, you know, so what do you prefer? Do you prefer acting or directing? Or writing?
Right now, I kind of prefer writing and directing right now, because it's new, and it's a new field to try to achieve things that I haven't done, and it's a bit more challenging. I mean, acting is great for an instant kind of gratification. It's fun to be, you know, in the moment, and you know, to be with the other actor in front of the camera and not kind of knowing what's going to happen. And that's a great experience. But I think on the whole, I must say, I kind of prefer writing and directing right now.
Thank you, John.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks,
man.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right, Dolph, you have to come back to our show when we have a full half hour with you. This is just the conversation's been too great, and we'd love to have you back
thanks.
On sometime in the future.
I'd love to come back. It's been fun. I appreciate it. Good questions and a great format you guys have.
It very much is. It's great. This Blog Talk Radio is a fantastic forum. So we appreciate you taking part today. Best of luck to you on your movie, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Robert Forrester, we all know him, we love him, and everything from Jackie Brown to Alligator. I mean,
I love Alligator.
Yes, absolutely.
My dad hated that movie. He almost kept trying to turn it off when that first came on TV. So.
Man, I remember as a kid that was a favorite. I mean, it was playing on cable all the time, and we always watched it. It was something else. He's had such a long, distinguished career, and I'm happy to report he is absolutely one of the nicest people I've ever had the pleasure of talking to. I mean, just an absolute gentleman and so genuine. So here is Robert Forster talking about some of the extraordinary collaborations he's had throughout his career and his new film, Calamity, which is written and directed by James Housler and is currently in limited release.
I can't do this right now, Alice. Barbie has Ken.
I've said it. Father said it to me. If it's meant to be, love will find a way.
Yes. Please, hear me out.
I don't think we should talk.
Hey.
I can feel you obsessing.
I can't stop. We all make rash decisions.
Is that what happened to you, Billy?
Hello, I'm Stan.
Ashley.
Oh, Ashley.
Don't say that name.
You're my friend at best, Ellen. I'm not even sure you can handle that.
I can see Ashley has been hard at work. Catch up with you later. When you're not with this doormat.
What if something happened to Alan?
What did you say?
Would you be heartbroken?
I want to be like him. I don't want to feel what he's feeling.
Where is he? I'm not sure he can come back from. Subconscious rip. Animalistic rage.
You're lying to your best friend's face!
The search begins for a young woman of 24. She has not been seen for 2 days.
You hear me? We're friends.
You're
making me feel crazy here, Stan.
You think you're crazy?
No.
So tell me about your first reaction when you received the script for Calamity.
Well, I know James Housler. I did a picture with him several years ago, so I knew him. And he said, look, I don't have anything for you in this movie, but there's the part of the father of the guy. He said, would you be willing to come to Virginia and shoot it? It'll take about 6 hours. I said, well, of course I would. So, you know, this is not a big part in his movie, but I was in his other movie, one of his other movies, called Wild Seven. And and that movie was shot in Arizona 2 or 3 years ago with a couple old pals of mine, Richard Roundtree and Robert Loggia. We play three crooks looking to knock over a bank, and it turns out that my son... and his gang of ne'er-do-wells are trying to knock off the same bank. And at the end of the movie, we encounter each other, guns pointed at each other, trying to rob the same bank. So that was Wild Seven. And when he said, can you come to Virginia for 1 day of shoot, I said, by all means, tell me when. And I went there. And as I saw in the production notes, it was raining, and it rained and rained until I left.
But obviously, you have a rapport with Mr. Housler. Tell me about that working relationship and what you respond to with him.
You know, he's an interesting guy and a very nice guy. He's not a Hollywood guy at all. He's quiet and, you know, a little on the shy side. He reminds me of David Lynch, and his movies are a little... like David Lynch. They're quiet and slow, and once you get into the rhythm of his movie, you realize these characters are believable people, saying believable things. They aren't movie people pushing a plot. When I started in this business, you know, in 1964 and 5, lines of dialogue were meant to push plot. The actor had to take a line, and the director would sometimes say, see what you can do with this line, you know. And it was meant to get all the information possible in a short spurt and move the story forward. This movie is not like that, or David Lynch's for that matter, or even Clint Eastwood, who also makes slow, deliberate movies. Once you get into the rhythm of them, however, you're in for a nice ride. And in this picture, Calamity, I don't know whether you're spilling the story or not, but this is about something that almost every guy I've ever known has had to deal with, and women too, but I know more about it from the guy's side. This is a movie about heartbreak and
sure.
Getting dumped by a girl or losing the girl or being sad about the girl and how different people react to that. And here you've got two very different reactions to having been dumped or losing the girl in this movie, Calamity. And you know, it's real on a lot of fronts. You probably also know it's opening tomorrow in New York and Los Angeles.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned it's a movie about broken relationships and the heartbreak that can cause, mainly from the male perspective. And we've seen a lot of films on that subject matter, but nothing like this, nothing quite told in this way. So he seems to be a very outside of the box filmmaker.
He certainly is. And when you look at, as I said, for instance, David Lynch, you look at his early movies, or even, you know, any of them, they take their time and tell you a story and give you an opportunity to warm into it and understand it. And at the end of this movie, I was very glad that James, in the voiceover, there's a tiny voiceover that starts at the beginning and touches us at the end, and he reminds us that the ways in which we deal with pain defines us as a human being. And these two guys, each in his own way, respond to the pain of the loss in quite different ways, as you know. You've seen the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great film. You were talking about the dialogue, and the dialogue not necessarily being crafted to just propel plot points.
Yeah.
As in Lynch's work. Does that allow you a certain freedom as an actor?
Now, I worked with David Lynch in Mulholland
Absolutely.
Drive.
Yeah.
And I must admit that when I read the script, now, when I read it and shot it, it was a pilot for one of his interesting, odd television shows. You remember the other one, Twin Peaks?
Twin Peaks, yes, sir.
Well, what do I want to say about Twin Peaks? You didn't know where it was going, and
mm-hmm.
neither did we when I read the script of Mulholland Drive. So it was a pilot for a television show. Later, of course, when it didn't succeed as a television show, when it didn't get picked up, they shot some additional material and made it into a standalone movie. But when I shot it, I didn't understand it, nor did I understand where it was going. All I knew was that I was a detective in a situation, and I only shot, a couple of days, a couple of half days, a couple of half nights. And on my first shooting night, we were on a road, maybe in Griffith Park, above Los Angeles, with all of the beautiful lights of Los Angeles spread out before us. And I walked from the scene of an accident over to the edge of the other side of the road, and I look over Los Angeles, and I say some lines, and I can't remember who I'm talking to at this moment, but I did the scene, and, you know, I have a feeling for the rhythm of a believable line of dialogue, and I did my line. And David said after the shot, he said, do it slower. And I thought, okay, I can do it slower, and I did it slower. And on the following take, he said, do it slower still. Now I'm beginning to think, what is this guy asking me to do? Because it's not sounding real anymore. It's sounding something else. I finally did the line slower than I can imagine or than I would ever imagine saying a line without saying to a director, hey, guess what? This doesn't sound real to me. I can't do it like that. But this is David Lynch. And I said, okay, Bob, give him the line the way he wants it. Eventually, I realized that this scene was not a real scene, but was in a dream,
yeah.
Something I didn't know on the set. And going with the director, this is a good director, you know. That's when I said to myself, hey, Bob, don't second-guess the director. This guy knows what he's doing. And finally, when I realized that I was in a dream sequence, then the line, the slowness of the line made sense. But he didn't expose that to me until after the movie was released as a standalone movie. So did you actually
shoot more than that initial scene that ended up in the movie? Did you shoot more for the pilot?
Yes, and I can't remember what all stayed in the movie, but if it had gone as into series, he said that he'd, you know, find out when I wasn't working on something else, because at that time I was working a lot. This was right after Jackie Brown, and I had a lot of stuff going on. You know, things cool off after a while, but at that point he said, you'll come in and we'll shoot little scenes, and that'll be my part of the television show. So I was delighted, and this is a guy that I liked long before and was dying to work with. And so anyway, he was extremely nice to me, David Lynch, and working with him reminds me a little bit of working with James Housler. They're both deliberate, they're both quiet, they're both reserved, and they ask you to do something and you think, this guy knows what he wants. Let's give it to him. But I had very little to do in Calamity. I had a lot more to do in Wild 7.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about writing and different styles of writing. And obviously you mentioned Jackie Brown, which is the biggie from from this act of your career.
His biggie is my biggie, I'll tell you.
Yeah. And that Tarantino's dialogue seems, I mean, it obviously is its own music. It has a rhythm all of its own. So that must be a kind of a different monster altogether to tackle. I mean, that has to pretty much be exact as written to not miss any of the poetry.
It's very possible that Ordell's killed somebody. You realize that?
Well, I ain't going back to jail, and I ain't doing that probation thing again. Max, how do you feel about getting old?
You're not old. You look great.
No, I'm asking you, how do you feel about getting old? Doesn't it bother you?
It's not really something I think about.
Really?
Oh, I guess I got a little sensitive about my hair a few years ago. It started falling out, so, I did something about it.
How do you feel about that?
I feel fine with it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. I did it to feel better about myself, and, I do. Look in the mirror. Looks like me.
Yeah, but it's different for men.
I can't really feel too sorry for you in this department. I bet that except for possibly an afro, you look exactly the way you did at 29.
Well, my ass ain't the same.
Bigger?
Yeah.
Ain't nothing wrong with that. Something else worry you?
I always feel like I'm starting over. How many pounds you said you're up?
15,000.
Is that a lot?
It's plenty.
Well, I've flown over 7 million miles, and I've been waiting on people for 20 years. And after my bust, the best job I could get was with Cabo Rare, which is the worst job you can get in this industry. I make $16,000 a year plus retirement benefits that ain't worth a damn. And with this arrest hanging over my head, Max, I'm scared. And if I lose this job, I gotta start all over again, and I ain't got nothing to start over with. I'll be stuck with whatever I can get. And that shit is more scary than Ordell.
Quentin Wright is a master of dialogue. He hears it. He hears it in his mind, and there was very little room for improvisation in that movie. But that didn't mean that I was constrained in any way, because he wrote this thing so well that. And the way I work on dialogue, I take the script and I read the lines and I try to understand the scene. I try to understand what place this scene has in the movie. You know, there's some detective work, but eventually you put the script down and you try to say the line the way you think you remember the line in the script, and then you go back to the script and see how close you got to the way the guy wrote it. Well, this guy writes material so well that the way you'd phrase something, that way you'd phrase something is the way it's written. This guy is so good. We're talking about Tarantino. So whereas there were no real opportunities for improvisation, I needed none because this guy's dialogue is so good. The only moment in the movie that I can remember, maybe there were others, but the only moment that I can remember in the movie was the very last scene when Pam Grier comes to my office and we kiss. And she is about to leave, and she wants me to go to Spain with her. And I am sort of trying to make up my mind whether I dare leave my office and run away with this woman. And the phone rings. Now, there was not, it seems to me, that wasn't in the movie. It wasn't in the script. But while we're shooting that, Quentin says to me, "There'll be a moment in your office when the phone will ring. Pick it up." And there was a moment when the phone rang. And I picked it up, and I improvised what was going on in that telephone call. As I pictured some woman whose son was in trouble, and I asked her how old the kid was maybe, and does he live at home or is there a father at home? I can't quite remember, but that was improvised. There was just a moment in the movie where, but other than that, Quentin Tarantino writes masterfully, and I know that he wrote it with me in mind, and so you know, it sort of conformed to me easily.
Yeah, well, you're fantastic in that. You're fantastic in everything. I've loved watching you over the years. Your work means a lot to me as a, you know, obviously a movie geek that I am.
It's great to be overrated, Jamie.
No, you're not overrated. I just have one more question for you. You've been doing this for a long time, and I'm wondering if acting means something different for you now than it did when you were starting.
Well, when I was starting, I had no idea that there were a zillion of us and a very small number of jobs. I went to New York City in 1964 thinking, how hard could it be? Kids can do it. And so I went to New York without knowing the amount of competition there was. Ignorance was my friend. Now I seem to know how much competition there is. And so that element is different from when I first started. The other thing, I guess, is that it's become a job. I understand the needs of production. I try very hard to accede to the needs of production. You know, they've got to get a certain amount of work done every single day. They have a finite number of shots that got to get done. And I, by the amount of experience that I've had, know how to help them get it. In the beginning, it was a lot less understandable to me, but people helped me. I had a great director in the first guy, John Huston, and from there, you know, it was a learning experience, and it continues to be. Every single shot is an opportunity to deliver the best you got at that moment. And so it continues to be what it was at the very beginning, an opportunity to do your very best.
You mentioned John Huston and David Lynch and Mr. Hausler and Tarantino, and you worked with the greats. And I'm curious, is there a single most valuable lesson you've learned from in any of these giant directors?
John Huston told me when I was doing the wardrobing, I said, when I was doing the wardrobing, he said to me, I told him I had never done a movie. This is prior to doing any picture. And it was on the phone. It wasn't wardrobing. When I was on the phone with him after he gave me the job and the agents arranged a telephone call, and I said, "Now, I appreciate the fact that you hired me," I said, "but do you remember I told you I never did a movie?" He says, "I remember." I said, "Well, and reading my mind at the other end of the telephone," he says, "I'll give you some instruction." And so for months I expected this guy to give me some instruction. And it wasn't until the day we started the movie, after telling me, "Yes, wait, I'll give it to you. But eventually on the first day of production, I got out of the car. They drove me to the set, and as I get out of the car, John Huston says, "Now's the time, Bobby." I said, "Shoot, I'm all ears." He says, "Go take a look through the lens." And I walked over to the camera. The cameraman stepped aside. I looked through the lens at the scene that we were about to shoot, and I turned back to Huston, and he had his hands formed the way, you know, a guy shows you how, with the frame lines, you know, sort of a box with his fingers. And he said, "You see those? Those are the frame lines." And I looked back through the lens, and I said, "You mean that the line that shows the cameraman what the audience sees?" He says, "Yes, those are the frame lines. Now, ask yourself this. What needs to be there?" He made me realize that it wasn't only one thing that I had to know, but I had to understand how the writer wanted the material to be, what the writer intended for me, and what I was supposed to deliver in that scene. And in addition to that, the director has some instructions for me so that when the guy says action, I need to do what the director needs of me. In addition, the one who set the lights wants me to be in them. Or the one who, the word's got to be correct. Otherwise, at the end of the shot, the sound guy says, "No good for sound, start again." Or if I put the cup in the wrong spot, somebody says, "No good for continuity, start again." Or if I do something too big for the shot I'm in, the guy behind the lens says, "No good for composition, start again." I realize from John Huston's remark that that everybody on that set is your boss, and you need to deliver something to everybody on that set, including the editor, who you need to know how the ups and downs of this movie go, how what the roller coaster track looks like of this movie, so that going down and going up and going around the turns, you can contribute to the editor's needs and to the audience's needs, who need to believe what's going on. Otherwise, they'll fly out going around the corner if they don't believe what's going on. And for the one who hired me, the producer, I got to help bring this movie in on time. I need to be ready to deliver on that first or second or the third take. So you owe something to everybody on that movie, and it was contained in John Huston's original piece of information, the original piece of advice to me, which was take a look through the lens and see that frame line and ask yourself what needs to be there. This guy gave me a real big hint right at the top of my career.
Well, it's true. There are so many balls you have to manage and balance up in the air. Does it become easier for you, the actual technicality of giving a performance?
Well, look, you know, judging from the fact that there are actors I know who I wouldn't trust with a grocery list, who can do those things, they'll keep those balls in the air, do that 8 days a week. It couldn't be that hard. But you get better and better understanding quicker what you can do to be helpful. And so, as I said earlier, I think the years of experience have given me, what with to help movie makers to get their shots, because that's what this business is. It's a business of making movie shots, so many a day, and then letting the guy cut them together and make a movie that he wanted to make.
Absolutely. I can't thank you enough for giving me your time today. I'm just a huge admirer of your work, and let's do this again. I'd love to talk to you sometime in the future.
Jamie, you got my undivided attention. I thank you very much for yours.
A good friend to first-time directors is actually one of his co-stars,
of the film, who was Ron Perlman. And one of the first-time directors that Ron Perlman shepherded early on in his career was none other than Guillermo del Toro, and that paid off in dividends with Hellboy, the Hellboy series, which has really reinvigorated Mr. Perlman's cult status, something that started way back in the day with the Beauty and the Beast television series. And he really is a phenomenon of an actor. He's one of those guys that we love to follow on screen, and he works quite a lot. He has quite a lot of credits to his name, and he's very distinctive in every single one of those projects. Here we talk about the film Mutant Chronicles, what he likes about the character, and a few other things about the craft of acting. My understanding of the project, it's kind of a big-budget project made on a smaller budgeted scale. They used all the tools in their arsenal to make it look very impressive. And I was wondering, for you as an actor, you've done so much work, big budget, smaller budget. Does that dictate any change in performance? Does it dictate different demands in your performance?
No, I mean, you always come to the work with the same set of parameters, the same hopefully levels of engagement. You know, the circumstances change, but there are certain things that must never change, you know, which is the approach to the work. I actually appreciate the underdog in these scenarios.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more than I appreciate the you know being in a situation where the machine is so overwhelmingly large and unwieldy.
Yeah.
And in this case, you know, watching Simon make what essentially is an amazingly high concept tentpole-like film with the resources he had, and I'm not at liberty to mention how much this movie was made for, but trust me when I tell you, it's a fraction of what, you know, would have been spent for the same kind of movie, you know, under different circumstances.
Yeah.
And yet the movie, I've seen it now twice. I'm quite proud of it. Never once does it look like it's breathing heavy. Never once does it look like it's been compromised or fudged or made to look cheesy because they just, you know, on any given day got undermined by, you know, their lack of resources. And I have to give all the credit in the world for you know, the high quality of what ultimately appears on the screen.
Yeah.
To Simon Hunter. You know, he took him a year and a half to finish the film because he had nothing to work with, and he had to do everything in such a painstakingly low-tech way. But he did it, and he did it in such a way that the film is worth everyone's attention.
Yeah.
And he's a filmmaker of rare and unique ability.
I would certainly agree, and I think it's a very impressive looking movie, and so when I mentioned a smaller budget, that wasn't I wasn't speaking about the quality of the film, because obviously it's a high quality film, but in terms of the working environment, when he spoke of it, he said that all of you were such a tight kind of unit, and you're all in there working to put this thing together the way it deserved to be. Did you feel that on this set, that there was a level of kind of intimacy, like everyone was in it for a common purpose?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I every one of us to a man believed very much in the ethereal, high quality, intelligent way that this material was being depicted, and appreciated the fact that we might, you know, be involved in something special. So the level of enthusiasm was high.
Yeah.
The company of actors that were assembled were phenomenal.
They're amazing, yeah.
And you know, no egos. There was nobody that was you know, a part of this production that was making retirement money. Certainly, I mean, you know, we were all doing this because we believed in the material, and nobody was getting rich. which makes for the playing field to be rather even. And it's an environment I like working in because there's no cynicism. You know,
yeah.
The order of the day is enthusiasm and devotion and the desire to help a young filmmaker achieve his vision rather than some other set of, you know, agendas or circumstances.
Oh, yeah.
So
what did
yeah.
you respond to in this? I'm so sorry if I broke your train of thought.
No, I was done. Well, I first and foremost responded to how intelligently the script was written. You know, I loved, you know, the way he solved the problem of what a world 400 and some years into the future would look like, that there are no longer any nations, but that now that the world has been divvied up into four overwhelmingly powerful corporations, corporations being soulless and heartless and, you know, not having to answer to any of the tenets of the human condition.
Right.
So that immediately got my attention, and the dialogue was smart and crisp, and the characters were compelling and sympathetic and real. And then, of course, the character that they asked me to look at, Brother Samuel, was somebody who I truly aspired spending time with, and because he's such a humanist in a world that has been so dehumanized, and he's got, you know, just this amazing heart and single-minded devotion toward preserving what is good in mankind, and to the point where he's willing to, you know, put his own life on the line.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something quite important about, you know, being given the opportunity to play a guy like that.
Yeah. And when you speak about the character like you just did, tell me about your criteria with choosing roles, because you've got a lot of credits under your belt. And so when you read a script, do you look for that particular character? Do you look for the company that you're going to be involved in, the script itself? What's your criteria for choosing roles?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all of those things. First and foremost, I got to feel like I can play the guy. You know, if I feel like I don't have a strong handle on what the writer is looking for, then, you know, I stay away. But so that's first and foremost. Second of all, is it something that I've never done before, and how engaged do I think I can be by trying to figure out who the guy is? And that's what it is. It's an exercise in trying to figure out who the guy is, and, you know, he's got to be interesting enough and idiosyncratic enough and unique enough to want to spend 3, 4, 5, 6 months with. And then, of course, it's all the other things. It's like, do these people have a shot of making this film commensurate with what the potential of it is on the page? Do they have the resources? Do they have the other cast members? Is this director equipped for... Because if you know you're going to go into something that has a big chance of failing, you know, you try to avoid those situations. So
right.
That's it. That's the whole criteria for me.
Well,
having said that, I like working with first-time directors a lot because when I did Guillermo del Toro's film Kronos, he had never directed anything before, and, you know, there I was getting a chance to participate in the emergence of what is turning out to be one of the most important voices in cinema that we have.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And I love the idea of maybe making Lightning Strike again and, you know, being involved with somebody else who's emerging and getting a shot at being a new important voice. So I'm a sucker for low budget. I'm a sucker for first-timers.
Yeah, I think that's
and I'll
great.
I'll always make little adjustments, you know, to try to accommodate those requests when they come in.
And you also strike me as an actor who is in love with the process. You like to work, and I'm wondering if that speaks to your stage experience. If you can speak a little about what you feel as an actor when you walk on a film set, what your extensive stage experience does for you.
Well, I'm so far from my early days on stage. You know, I'm what I learned by the old days in theater, which were basically in the 60s and 70s,
mm-hmm.
And a little bit in the 80s, I guess, in the early 80s, was, you know, just what a professional actor has to do to be ready on the day to do what he's been asked to do. So there was a work ethic that was strongly articulated. And then there was the relationship with the material, you know, that, you know, you have an obligation to do what you think the writer intended, and to find ways to shine a light on it, do your part. Your little part is a fraction of what ends up being the whole, but, you know, you're obligated first and foremost to do the material. Along the way, you know, you just pick up little tidbits of, you know, building character and the technical aspects of it. Just that all just comes with the doing of it over and over and over again to varying degrees of success and failure. And there's a lot of failure. There's a lot of trial and error. There are a lot of things that I did that were tremendously horrible that I learned more from than things that I did that were okay. So
yeah.
You have to embrace the possibility of falling on your face understand that, you know, there's as much to be learned from that as long as you don't crash and burn than as there is anything else you could be occupying your time with.
Absolutely. Let me ask you one more question before I let you go, because I know you're pressed for time, and I appreciate this very much. It's a great honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you.
Another tremendous actor that you get to work with, and this has just a fantastic cast, as you mentioned, is Malkovich. Now, he's fascinating to me. Tell me your insights into how he works.
Well, he really, really, really has a completely unique way of working. Unfortunately, he was only on this movie for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, in the unfortunateness of it, all of the scenes he had were with me. So on those 2 days, you know, if I was able to get any kind of window, I was the only one in the cast that did. But I would never be able to put my finger on what John's process is. He's a very bright guy. I think from the neck up, he's like in a class by himself, and he utilizes that great intellect in his, you know, the imaginative process that goes into who a character is and how he wants to portray that character.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when you ask John to do a job, it's not going to get done like anybody else is going to do it. That's for sure, because he doesn't think like anybody else. He thinks very much about idiosyncrasies. You know, once he absorbs who he thinks the character is, then he thinks about behavior and idiosyncrasy. And it's a very brave way of working. Because he likes to put himself on the thinnest branch of the tree and then just hope he doesn't, you know, fall off. And I admire guys who have those, you know, balls big enough to work like that.
Yeah, like
so I really
tightrope. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I really I enjoyed my 2 days with John.
Well, Ron, thank you so much, my friend. I love what you do, and I appreciate your time very much today.
My pleasure, my friend. It was nice chatting with you.
That's it for this episode of the Best of Movie Geeks United. You can access our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews by visiting moviegeeksunited.net.